Shalom. Welcome to another episode of Inspiration from Zion. I'm Jonathan Feldstein, and I have the privilege of being your host, coming to you from the Judean Mountains here in Israel. I like to refer to it as the original Bible Belt. Inspiration from Zion is a program of the Genesis 1-2-3 Foundation, whose mission is to build bridges between Jews and Christians with Israel in ways that are new, unique, and meaningful. I pray that you will find this, all of those. Through this program, we're excited to connect you to people and stories in and relating to Israel to give you a window to look through, experiencing aspects of life here that you might not otherwise know about. We want this to be interactive, so please be in touch at inspirationfromzion@gmail.com and send along any questions about any topic anytime. Or you can reach us at genesis123.co or follow and like Inspiration from Zion on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Stay tuned until the end, where, as always, we have an exciting opportunity, and please feel free to share this with others who will also find it of interest. A friend and colleague of mine, Dr. Chagai Dvir, made an introduction thinking with today's guest, thinking that we would have something in common, and indeed, not only do we have something in common in our first visit together a few weeks ago over an extended and engaged coffee, kind of makes you one of the people you want to make time to get together with on a regular basis, somebody who I just got to know. And he was good enough to bring me a copy of his wonderful book. Let me see if I can hold it up here with the virtual background. It's hard. A Bridge to Your Roots, an Evangelical Guide Throughout the Land of Israel, Evangelical Journey Throughout the Land of Israel. The author is Shai Shval. He's a Israeli born and raised certified tour guide here in Israel with over a decade of experience leading groups and individuals throughout the land of Israel. He's a graduate with in honors with Middle Eastern Studies from the University of Haifa and specializes in guiding evangelical groups here in Israel, connecting them with the roots of their faith. Shai is the author of Know the Holy Land, a groundbreaking Hebrew-English dictionary that explores the land of Israel through geography, geology, archaeology, architecture, flora, and fauna, and more. And his latest book, which I'm holding in my hand, A Bridge to Your Roots, invites readers on a tremendous journey of faith, history, and connection, serving as a bridge to their own spiritual roots as Christians. Through his work, Shai fosters interfaith dialogue and inspires reflection, exploration, and a renewed sense of purpose. Now, for those of you who've been following Inspiration from Zion, the webinar is 5 years old. The podcast is 6 years, is 4 years old. You know that I don't do book reviews terribly often, very rarely, maybe once a year, maximum twice. This is important. It's important because of the topic. It's important because of who we are, the Genesis 1-2-3 Foundation, building bridges between Jews and Christians. There's a natural synergy because the picture which we're going to talk about, the cover picture, is a beautiful multi-branched olive tree with big, big root structure, which is, of course, connected to our program, Root and Branch. And Shai, before I begin and welcome you and turn on your mic, so to speak, I just want to give you a shout out for the tremendous content that you've published here in how many? 400 and... almost 416 pages. I learned a lot. I know a lot, but I learned a lot from your book. You've pulled together sources from multiple languages, many different cultures, the main monotheistic religions, and thousands of years of history, going from more than 3,000 years ago until today. And I'm so thrilled and I'm so grateful that I have a copy now. My wife, who is a tour guide, has not yet read it, but I know I told her she couldn't until I finish. Now, since I'm traveling this week, she'll have it to read while I'm gone. And I'm just excited to have you join and talk about the book, and for which I highly recommend. We want to tell people how to get it and learn more about it. So welcome to Inspiration from Zion.
Thank you very much, Jonathan, for this introduction. And I really feel privileged to meet you because the kind of things that you're doing is really the kind of stuff that is very, very close to my heart and to my perception, because I fully believe that building bridges between Jews and Christians is something that is very, very important for both of us, for the roots and for the branches. And thank you.
Right. Well said. And there are, it would be interesting to do a proportional study, but of how many roots Jews or how many branches Christians are actually understanding the significance of this kind of work and the building of bridges. But it's still very low. And that's something that we do from one perspective. You as a guide certainly do frontally with others, but your book now allows you to bring people through the land of Israel and history and you weave so many connections. It's really remarkable. Tell me, I mean, I know it, but I want you to tell the story. Where did this originate? I was blown away when you first told me about the concept and where it came from.
Wow. So there is a story which is at the background of my story. So the background story starts in New York on the summer of 1867.
A few years ago.
Yeah, 1867.
I understand.
Yeah. And this was 2 years after the end of the Civil War in the United States, which was a very bloody war. People were actually looking for some comfort to relieve themselves from the horrors of the war, one. And two, many vessels were released from the Navy. And so those two elements were put together. And the very first commercial cruise was launched on June 1867, living toward Europe. So they crossed the Atlantic. They came to several sites in classical Europe. At that time, it was the same classical Europe that we are that we used to be familiar with before the latest changes. And so they visited. First of all, they visited the International Exhibition in Paris that attracted many, many visitors from all over the world. They visited the Vatican, and ultimately they got to Istanbul, and then they got to the port in Beirut in Lebanon. And then 8 brave people got off the ship, and on the pier a local tour guide waited for them with a caravan of mules, with tents and mattresses and blankets and all of these. And they started a journey of riding. Now, one of those 8 people that got off the steamboat was Mark Twain. And Mark Twain in 1867 was in his early 30s. He wasn't yet the very famous writer that we are all familiar with. And he was actually sent as a reporter by a newspaper from California to cover the first cruise. So
They paid him a good amount of money.
Right. They paid him. Obviously, I like very much the special way that Mark Twain writes. Okay, his very special humor, his cynical sense. And so after he came back, once he realized that the pieces that he sent were so, so popular, he combined all those chapters, all the articles together. And that's how the book named The Innocents Abroad was born. Now, I know that it's not enough people that are aware to this, but The Innocents Abroad was the most successful book written by Mark Twain. Yes.
No kidding.
I see the shock on your
really?
Face.
Really? That is shocking. My kids, since they grew up here, have never read Mark Twain, but I talk about Huckleberry Finn and
right.
What's the other one?
Tom Sawyer.
Yeah. I was washing dishes the other night talking to one of my 30-year-old daughter about this and remembering, and she's a vivacious reader, talking about some of the imagery that he used in Mark Twain that's so brilliant that I still remember from from 45 years ago.
So most of the people that I happen to guide as an Israeli tour guide in Israel happen to be more or less in our age and above. And so this generation obviously is very, very familiar with Mark Twain. Most of those people, they like Mark Twain. And as a tour guide, I used to quote from the book to the guest that I was guiding. And a British friend gave me this very special verb. The idea was percolating in my mind to write something that will connect the book written by Mark Twain and the Land of Israel and the evangelical people that became more and more vital in my work. And me, humble, shy, but I never found the time. I was too busy guiding and working. And then God decided to give you and me and all of our watchers and listeners, God decided to give us plenty of free time. This is when COVID came. And so after a while, since the gates of Israel were totally blocked and tourism industry in practicality collapsed, I found myself finally sitting down and writing the first chapters of this book.
How did you start? Did you read all of Innocents Abroad? Because you wrote it very significantly, and I really enjoyed that.
I never read the entire book. I need to be frank.
As long as people read your book entirely, we don't care. Mark Twain's book.
I read, and believe me, I read it many, many times. I read the Israeli or the Palestine, as it was named back then. I hope we'll have some time in order to relate to the origin of this name. But anyway, I related to the Land of Israel. Let's call it like this. That's the proper term that I'd love to use. I read the part that relates to the Land of Israel many, many times, both in Hebrew and in English. The entire book is more than 500 pages. Actually, mine is nearing 500. So now it seems to be less threatening. But anyway, the full version of Mark Twain's book, The Innocents Abroad, and I highly recommend you to read it. You can find, by the way, you can find it on, maybe you can also place the link under the Gutenberg Project. Okay. If you're not familiar with the Gutenberg Project, that's a fantastic project that actually memorize and conserve books that have no longer bear any copyrights.
Oh.
And so The Innocents Abroad is one of those books that are kept under the Gutenberg Project.
Got it.
And okay. So obviously I read many, many times the local chapters, and I was fascinated with this, and I was especially fascinated by the reaction of my guests. So I knew that somehow I would like to incorporate Mark Twain in my future book. And then after 2 years, finally in the spring of 2022, the gates were reopened. So I left the writing aside. Obviously, I started guiding again. And I haven't finished yet the book back then in 2022. And then God realized that I haven't finished yet the job, the mission that I took upon my shoulders.
I'm afraid you're going to say what I think you're going to say.
Yeah, and in a very tragic way, he made me some more time to sit down, and this time to finish writing the book. So as you said, the book is quite comprehensive. Just a few words about the content of the book. 3/4 of the book are actually similar in a way to the itinerary that Mark Twain did in 1867. Okay, so we start in the Upper Galilee, in the what you would call the Galilee Panhandle. That's this small piece of land that goes kind of into Lebanon. That's the most northern part of Israel. And there we have Caesarea Philippi, or Banias, as we call it in Hebrew and in Arabic.
So they took mules from Beirut to the Gaza.
They rode all the way from Beirut to Damascus. Now more and more people are aware to the fact that Damascus is not located at the central part of Syria, but rather at the south part.
Correct.
Some 50 kilometers away from the Golan Heights.
Right.
So Mark Twain actually, he entered the land of Israel from a place that has no spiritual connotation. This place is Kalat Namrud, Nimrod Fortress.
Oh, sure.
On the slopes of Mount Hermon.
Yeah.
This is the exact place where he's delivering a wonderful geological lesson about the crumbling stones that he sees at this very impressive fortress. So anyway, I go all the way from the north part of Israel, from the Galilee, through the Jezreel Valley, through Samaria, Shomron, as we call it in Hebrew. Shiloh, Bethel, coming to Jerusalem, then a quick jump to the Jordan Jordan River, coming back through the Jerusalem, going to the Judean lowland, or as we call it in Hebrew, the Shfelah, where some very important places are located. And
right, our followers will know the Elah Valley, which is actually one of the chapters that was particularly engaging to me.
Right. So for instance, in the Elah Valley, I go to the top of what I usually call the Bible Theater. And I really hope that our viewers and listeners, God willing, will be able once or twice or more to go to the top of Tel Azekah and really see with their own eyes at the battlefield where David and Goliath fought. And that's really a very tangible place where you can really feel and the Bible really comes to life. Yeah. So anyway, just to finalize, so the final stages of the book is in Jaffa, Yafo. And the final chapter is in Tel Aviv, where I deal with the modern Zionism and things like this.
Well, Tel Aviv, which didn't exist until 40 years later.
Right.
It didn't begin until 40 years later, but Jaffa, the ancient port.
Right. Jaffa, obviously, is one of the ancient ports in the Mediterranean basin. Many of our listeners probably remember that Jonah, Prophet Jonah, boarded the ship going all the way to Tarshish and later on to Nineveh. He did it in Jaffa.
This year, you can join Christian leaders from around the world who are lining up to participate in Root and Branch, the newest hands-on, meaningful, and incredibly tangible way for Christians to make a personal connection to Israel, the Israeli people, and to be a blessing to the people and nation which is still suffering from the trauma of a horrific terrorist attack and war. Root and Branch offers unique comfort and a vision of peace, with tangible material benefits to Israelis who have suffered the trauma of war, specifically in and around the Gaza border area. Root and Branch is a unique agricultural pilgrimage. You will harvest wild olive trees in communities along the Gaza border that were devastated by the October 7, 2023 terrorist attack and massacre. In these communities and elsewhere, we will plant deep and lasting roots among Israelis of all backgrounds, making Root and Branch all the more innovative. Since the war began, more than $50 million in crops have been saved by volunteers. Root and Branch is the first such initiative to harvest olives. Proceeds from the olive oil that's being made will directly benefit these devastated communities, making Root and Branch a critical and significant project to bless Israel economically and spiritually in multiple ways. Root and Branch is a partnership between the Genesis 123 Foundation and NewPersia.org. For information, videos, and media about the experience, dates, pricing, and how you can register, please visit rootandbranchisrael.com.
So
I have a question.
Yeah, yes.
I can picture the whole loop, and it's a fascinating trip. It's almost something, you know, we have the Israel Trail, where people walk in, up and down the length of Israel. We have the Sea to Sea, where you can walk from the Sea of Galilee to the Sea of Mediterranean or vice versa, and other kinds of things like that. But this is a fascinating experience. So my question then is, you're a guide. You mentioned 8 people got off the ship in Beirut. Was there one guide with them the whole time who was prearranged, who actually knew this stuff?
Yeah. Most of the people stayed on the steamboat, and while the 8 brave people were riding the horses with a local guide, who was an Arab guide, the steamboat was sailing to the south. If you can picture the map of the eastern basin of the Mediterranean Sea, so from Beirut you sail to the south. And ultimately, they met the steamboat in the port in Jaffa. So those people were, I would say, quite brave, because you need to bear in mind that transportation back then, in terms of decent roads, not talking about paved roads, which didn't exist until...
Well, there were no paved roads because there were no cars, so it didn't matter.
Yeah.
They were on horses and donkeys.
Yes. So it was quite, the conditions were quite harsh for the people, although they were totally surprised by the romantic appearance of the tents and the mattresses and all of this that was arranged by the people that escorted the brave people.
That's the thing, is that not only were there not roads, but I guess they had something to carry water in, leather pouches or something, because you can go hours upon hours riding a horse and have no water source, and you have to have a guide who knows where you're going and be able to keep the pace, because you need to be at point X or Y or Z by a certain time at the end of every single day, so you can set up your camp. And that was, they didn't have a hotel to go to or a kibbutz guest house. It was all very, very rudimentary.
By the way, only in Jerusalem, they were obviously living in a hotel. But it was tough. And in one instance, by the way, Mark Twain's, is talking about the resentment of some local Arabs, local Muslims that didn't want infidels to use the water. It's not that the water were any holy water or whatever. Simply, they didn't want to share it with those Christian infidels that came from far away. And so,
What do you know about his guide? As a guide, I'm curious, when you're reading about who guided them, did Mark Twain write about this person? And what did you learn about that person? And how does that impact you as a guide?
Frankly, he didn't impact me.
No?
I cannot say that I took or I'm imitating some of his, some of the things that he did. He was the man to lead them, because obviously he spoke Arabic, and in those days we're talking about the 19th century. All of this region was ruled under the Ottoman Empire, and the locals they were speaking Arabic. So obviously none of the travelers spoke any Arabic whatsoever. So they needed a local guide, obviously. And by the way, I highly recommend getting a local guide anywhere you go, because getting such a guide can save a lot of time and money in most cases. And this was also the case back then in the 19th century. So he knew the road, he knew the languages, he knew how to go well with the locals in order to avoid trouble.
Yeah.
And yeah.
What did you learn about Mark Twain that you didn't know before this?
First of all, I learned that already in his early 30s, he was already a gifted writer.
Yeah.
And I love very much the very long sentence, the complex sentences that he's usually building. Sometimes I try to do similar things with my English. He was in a way his cynical attitude related also to some of the travelers that he was traveling with, because they were very, obviously they were very eager to come to the Terra Santa, to the Holy Land, right? They wanted very much to come to the Holy Land. And for instance, one of the most moving experiences that I usually have with my guests in the Galilee, in the Lower Galilee, where the Sea of Galilee is located, is getting on the on a ship in the Sea of Galilee. And so once they approach the Sea of Galilee, so they told the guide, get for us a ship. Money doesn't care. We right. don't care how much it's gonna cost. We have dreamt about this experience for years, and we would like to do this.
Which, by the way, then you could count maybe on one hand the number of such experiences that they could do. That would make a lot of sense. But you wrote about it really wonderfully.
Exactly. So as I said, for me, as a Jew, okay, I'm a Jewish tour guide. So for me, and obviously to the guests that I'm leading, this is really one of the most moving experiences at the Sea of Galilee. Because you're being at the exact area where Jesus and disciples were living, and it's very, very moving. Anyway, they meet somebody with a boat, and they ask for a quote, and he tells them the price, and they are shocked, and they try to bargain, and anyway. Mark Twain is picturing for us the picture that the ship is slowly vanishing toward the horizon. And this was the end for this dream of those people that they have dreamt about it for so many, many years.
Because they weren't prepared to pay the price. They were being
ignored. Yeah. So, for instance, this is something that he is laughing, he's ragging at them, because it doesn't get well together. The fact that on the one hand, they were willing, according to what they said, they were willing to pay anything needed, you know, to get on this boat. And finally, they didn't. So in a way, they missed one of the things that they were so eager to accomplish on this journey. So you find this very, very...
Because they strange. Wouldn't, because they, it wasn't... Because they didn't want to pay that much money. It was really just, what other things? I know we're jumping out of order sequentially, but I'm just trying to think. I know when
it fits my ADHD, so it's okay.
Okay. I'm picturing their Jerusalem experience. I'm picturing, and he writes about it in a very funny way, they're going into the Jordan River, which I was very interesting to me because I didn't know this, but apparently they didn't like it in the Jordan River very much either because it was very cold, but yet it was summer. I was really curious, and I had to double check it after I read it, because I thought, oh, wow, it must have been February or March, but no, it was about as warm as the Jordan River must be, no?
It was September or October. I don't remember. On June, they left New York. But it took them a while to go through Europe,
right.
And to go. So they were in an area around September or maybe October, something like this.
Okay.
That's another funny experience. Again, for people of faith, for people of the Christian faith, obviously baptizing at the Jordan River is an ultimate experience.
Correct.
So again, this is something that they've been dreaming about for years, for decades, and finally they are there. Okay,
and they get in and they get out really quickly, and they're I don't think the word you use was cursing, but they're sort of cursing themselves as they're standing there cold and wet and
shivering
and not very happy with their experience. What other penultimate things did they do on that trip? They're fascinating things that they saw, but as far as an experience, if the land of Israel were an amusement park, we've now talked about the Sea of Galilee and the Jordan River. What are the other top two rides that they would have gone on then?
Obviously, Jerusalem.
Yeah.
And in Jerusalem, the main attraction was the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. That's the place that, according to some Christians, this is the place where Jesus was crucified, dying on the cross, buried, and resurrected. The initial format of the Church of the Holy Sepulchre was built at the 4th century CE by St. Helen, the mother of Constantine. And it has gone through many, many changes and the demolition and rebuilding and so on. So no doubt at the Christian quarter, this church is of course the leading place. And also it has a very big dome. It's next to the Golden Dome or the Dome of the Rock. And next to the dome of a prominent synagogue at the Jewish quarter, those three domes were, I would say, they characterized the skyline of Jerusalem back then. And so being there was very, very exciting for them. They've been at the church twice. So this was very, very moving. Other places.
Something else. I'm trying to walk my way through the chapters of the book. They didn't pick up rocks in the Elah Valley and start throwing them at a pretend Goliath. No, but
by the way, in some places, when they visited some archaeological site, they were trying to get what you call relics. They were trying to break some pieces as a memoir from those historic places. And by the way, because of this bad tradition of the visitors in holy places, once you visit the Church of the Holy Sepulchre and you are being next to Golgotha, next to the Rock of Golgotha, you can see that it's being covered, or in other words, protected by glass to prevent people of breaking pieces from the Rock of Golgotha and bringing those fragments to their home.
Wow.
Garden
Tomb did not yet exist?
No. Now, I'm very happy that you mentioned the Garden Tomb, because for our evangelical viewers, the real place for them is the Garden Tomb.
Right.
Okay. Now, I write about this in details in the book. First of all, I describe the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, because this is, I would say, that's the leading site at the Christian Quarter. The Christian Quarter is one out of four quarters in the old city of Jerusalem, and this church is the leading place in the quarter. But since the place became so important, and since Protestants were actually kept away by the Ottomans, remember, who rule the land of Israel for centuries, and they didn't allow the Protestant to build, for instance, Protestant churches until the mid 19th century.
Wow.
Okay. From the time of Martin Luther until the mid-19th century, no Protestant presence was in any place in the Middle East, but obviously the most important place in the Middle East is the land of Israel, and in the land of Israel, it's Jerusalem. So they could not build any church. Of course, they wanted initially to get a part at the most important place for Christians back then, and this is the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. But since the place was so important, nobody was willing to give up even one square inch, I would say, to the Protestants.
Right.
This I apologize if I'm ruining any romantic thoughts of some of our viewers, but that's I would say that's a historical background to the Garden Tomb, because another name for this is Gordon's Garden, because General Gordon was a British general that fought in Sudan and so on. He came to Jerusalem and looking for a place that can be marked as Golgotha, he found a place outside the old city, because right. The other tomb is not in the old city.
Because that's where property is going to be available. And it's
exactly.
It appears if you're doing something outside the walls of the old city.
Exactly. So the place that we all know as the Garden Tomb is located a few hundred yards to the north from Damascus Gate. And that's a must visit place, obviously, for Protestants, obviously for evangelical people. Sure. It's a very tranquil place. It is a very pleasant place. Obviously, it has a garden. But historically speaking, the grave that is being found there is dated to the first temple time. While Jesus lived during the second temple time.
But that doesn't mean it couldn't have been used in the second temple period.
Maybe. But the New Testament tells us that the grave was never used before.
I see. Okay, I didn't know.
Okay, but on the other hand, it's mentioned that it was in a garden. Okay. And at the Garden Tomb, we have a garden.
Okay.
So when people are visiting the Garden Tomb, in most cases, they find the place very, very appropriate because, as I said, it's very tranquil. It's a very pleasant place to contemplate and to pray to God and get connected with God.
Interesting.
But most of the archaeologists, most of the historians, they have major doubts about the place. Just to finalize this point, as I usually say to the people that I lead, the exact location to me and to the many of the people that I managed to deliver this message to them, the exact location is of less importance in comparison to the event that took place.
Correct.
Because the event is the most important things that happen. And all the events that you guys are reading in the New Testament and also in the Hebrew Bible, or the Old Testament, as some people call it, it's all happened here. So only once being here, you can really get connected with all your senses
right.
to the places.
Very nice.
The restoration of Jewish sovereignty in the land of Israel was an earth-shattering event. For Christians, it was a confirmation that God always keeps his covenantal promises. Today, we are blessed to see God's fingerprints in the modern miracle of the land of Israel playing out in our lives among the people and in the state of Israel. This year, on the occasion of Israel's 75th anniversary, the Genesis 123 Foundation has been privileged to bring together 75 Christian leaders from around the world to lend their unique voices, sharing their personal faith experiences relating to Israel and their in-depth insight into Israel's history and spiritual significance, creating an historical, one-of-a-kind, high-end coffee table book. Israel the Miracle. Israel the Miracle's stunning imagery will fill your home with the hope of fulfilled promises and conversations about Israel. It's a perfect gift to anyone for any occasion, and most of all, to yourself. You'll also be a blessing to Israel, knowing that the proceeds will go to bless Israelis of all backgrounds. Be a part of Israel the Miracle and bring the land, the people, and the state of Israel into your heart and into your home. Visit IsraelTheMiracle.com to get your limited edition copy today.
So here's a challenging question. You are a writer. You have two books. Mark Twain was a writer. He has a few more than you. If he were reading your book and we were sitting down in a cafe in Jerusalem on Ben Yehuda Street, which would be really fascinating, right? Because Ben Yehuda Street didn't exist and Jaffa Road, along which it's built, it was a dirt path. A road for horses and carriages between Jerusalem and Jaffa. If he were reading your book as a recount of his trip. By the way, I have to tell you something. Since I've been reading the book and it took me a few weeks to get through it all, I only noticed today I don't know if you did it on purpose, a bridge to your roots spelled R-O-O-T-S, and you have a beautiful root structure of the olive tree, and that's important symbolism in the land and between Jews and Christians. There's also a double entendre there, because roots can also be spelled R-O-U-T-E-S, and you're following the roots of Mark Twain. The root. Okay, I guess that wasn't on purpose. But there's a new insight for you to use. If you were sitting down with Mark Twain and he's just finished your book, and we're sitting there having a cafe afuch, cappuccino on Jaffa Street or Ben Yehuda Street, and he has his pipe in his hand and in his mouth, puffing away and thinking seriously about what his new friend Shai wrote, what do you think would be the most significant chat? Oh, by the way, before I ask you the question, which I just started to, one of the things that I like that you did so much is you start at a particular point. Here, I'm in chapter 15, Jesus' trial, death, burial, and resurrection. That's actually quite a significant chapter. But you also interweave it with modern things. And it's not just a straight linear path. You're expanding the vision with everything around it in a physical and a historical radius. So now you're back to Ben Yehuda Street with Mark Twain and me, and I'm just listening to your conversation. What chapter is the most significant one to him?
Well, let me go through the, you know. Obviously, one of the chapters of Jerusalem, because as I said, Jerusalem, not only for Mark Twain, for every visitor to the land of Israel in the past and also today, and probably also in the future, Jerusalem is something that is the most important place spiritually, historically, to the Jewish people, and obviously to the Christian people that are kind of branches, as we mentioned over and over in this talk. So Jerusalem, no doubt, is the most important place in Israel, and probably in the eyes of Mark Twain as well. I like to quote sometimes, apart from the book, he wrote an essay known as About the Jews, or something like this, well, he's talking about the fact that all the glory empires that once controlled this land, they vanish. Obviously, yeah. Wikipedia didn't exist back then, but you know, you can find the Babylonians today only in Wikipedia, okay? Right. Or the Assyrians, where are they? Right. They vanish, and the Jews, which are such a neglectable fragment of this planet population, they have such a tremendous effect on the not only on their lives, but over the lives of billions of people who live on this planet.
And he mentions that in 1867. That's pretty remarkable.
Yeah. Yes. So
go ahead.
I help people that attribute some anti-Semitic sentiments to Mark Twain, but I didn't find anything close to this. His description of the land of Israel are very saddening to people, let's say to you, Jonathan, and also to me. You know, the picture that he's delivering in the description of the land of Israel are horrible. Is describing, let's say, days when they were riding their horses and they barely saw a single human being after riding dozens of miles.
But that was a true depiction. It wasn't meant as a slander. He wasn't looking at modern Israel and saying that. He wasn't defaming anybody. He was just telling it like it was.
Obviously, today, many people with some hidden interest think that he was misled or that he was, I don't know, but he didn't have the political motivation to write this way because he wanted to deliver a message. He wrote down whatever he saw. He wrote the positive things. He wrote the negative things in relation to the people that he saw, to the people that he traveled with. He wrote exactly what he felt and what he saw. So to those people that think that that's a kind of a Zionist a scam, you know, to utilize some bad description of the land because this is the harsh reality that Mark Twain saw in 1867, whether you like it or not. That's what he saw.
But he's also writing from an American perspective. Now, of course, in America of 1867, but America had thriving cities. And in Israel in 1867, there was Jerusalem, which was what? A few tens of thousands of people. Jaffa, which was probably smaller than that. A port in Haifa, which, and not the city built up to the top, but only toward the bottom.
It was a small fisherman village.
There you go. And along the Sea of Galilee, that maybe there was a small encampment around what's now Tiberias. But again, and now it's still a very small city of only 50,000, right? So there wasn't much to see. He didn't miss the population centers. He saw them.
Back then, at the time of Mark Twain, the way that I see it, the glory of the land was mainly it was mainly rooted in the past. Today, as a proud Zionist, I can say that the glory of the land of Israel, the glory of the state of Israel, of the modern state of Israel, the one and only Jewish state in the world, it's the present, which is also our glory, because that's the way that I see, and that's what I deliver. Let me just finish this.
Yeah, go ahead.
This is something that I always deliver to the people that that I'm guiding in Israel. And it might sound, anyway, I'm sure that our listeners will know how to understand what I'm going to say. The blessing that the people that live in Israel and the blessing that the Jewish people gave to this planet is tremendously higher in comparison to our numbers. I just recently wrote an article talking about the chosen people. Okay. I should send you this article because I think you're going to find it very, very interesting. And so many people view the term chosen people and the Jewish people as people with privileges. But what I'm delivering in the piece that I wrote is that being chosen brings much more load and a bigger burden. Correct. It doesn't bring any privileges to us and bring us the message and the mission to spread the light all over the world. Yeah. That's the meaning for me to the chosenness of the Jewish people.
You were saying before about the glory of the land of Israel being in its present, I would just add that because the present is the fulfillment of the prophecy that Mark Twain only read about. And today, anywhere you go, you can show up in the land of Israel and you can physically experience multiple prophecies that exist here in the land that he didn't see and or appreciate.
He didn't see it because 1867 is a short time. It's a few decades before the Zionist movement, the modern Zionist movement, was born. Actually, Jews were coming to the land of Israel through the entire history of the land of Israel, obviously, but. After the Zionist movement was created, more and more Jews were coming to live in the land of Israel,
right.
And this is when we can see the fulfillment of the biblical prophecy.
Yes, exactly.
And this is another thing that I emphasize in the book, that to me and to you, since we are fortunate to live in the land of Israel, we can see with our own eyes, we can see the biblical prophecies that were delivered by Zechariah or by Isaiah or by Ezekiel. So for us, those biblical prophecies are not something that maybe one day we will see. No, we see old men and women in the streets That's of Jerusalem it. Today.
Yes.
We see boys and girls playing yes. in the streets of Jerusalem today.
Yes.
We see the resurrection of the dry bones of the Jewish people today. So we all those fruit, biblical prophecies.
We see the fruit on the trees, whether it's olives behind you, which we're going to talk about, or in my house that I sold 4.5 years ago with 7 fruit trees, where I could pick and taste prophecy in my front yard.
Exactly.
All of that. I'm curious, what from following his route, what did he miss? If you were his guide 150, almost 160 years ago, where would you have taken him to see something that he missed that would have been significant then in 1867?
So as I said, I visit in the book, I visit places that he was there. But as we mentioned earlier, Tel Azekah is being excavated now. But seeing the battlefield of David and Goliath, you don't need to dig into the ground. I use Etel is an artificial hill in Hebrew. And this term, by the way, is being used by archaeologists who doesn't speak any Hebrew whatsoever. Okay, but this artificial hill, Etel, T-E-L, like in Tel Aviv, for instance. Okay, Etel is something that is being created by inhabitation layer that was destroyed, and another one was built on top, destroyed, and another one. And finally, we get this Tel, we get an artificial hill. So Tel Azekah existed in 1867, okay? If Mark Twain would climb to the top of Tel Azekah, he could see with his own eyes from the top of the tel, from the top of the hill, as I mentioned, from this Bible theater, he could see the battlefield of David and Goliath.
And two years after the American Civil War, where he could have gone to the battlefields in Gettysburg, or I'm not remembering all my American history in terms of all the other battlefield sites, but it would have been very relevant, current to him, to see how a biblical battle took place as yes. compared to one 2,000 years later, 3,000 yeah. almost.
So there are places that weren't excavated there back then. Okay, for instance, a place called Qumran in the Judean desert.
Yep.
This is one of the most important archaeological places in Israel. And believe me, Israel is probably the most excavated place on the planet Earth. There are thousands of excavations that are being conducted right now all over the land of Israel. But Qumran, why Qumran is so important? Because in Qumran, in 1947, the Dead Sea Scrolls were discovered. The question who exactly wrote the scrolls is a very complicated question that I also deal with this issue in my book. But the point is that many leading archaeologists all over the world say that the discovery of the Dead Sea Scrolls, something like more than 900 different scrolls that cover the entire, almost the entire Jewish the entire Hebrew Bible, beside the scroll of Esther, which wasn't found, but beside the scroll of Esther, all the books of the Hebrew Bible were found in caves and in different locations around Qumran.
Wow.
So Qumran wasn't excavated back then. Or Lachish, which was a prominent city during the first temple period. Or obviously Magdala. Magdala is a fascinating site located right next to the Sea of Galilee. It was excavated 10, 15 years ago. It was found by chance, like many other things right. in the land of Israel. They wanted to build a convention center, and boom, they hit some rocks, started excavating, and boom. They found it
first. Remarkable there.
A first century.
You write about that very nicely, too. I enjoyed that That was one of the things. So let me ask you a question. We're now finishing. We've met for coffee, not just coffee, but breakfast. Mark Twain, you and I are sitting on Jaffa or Ben Yehuda Street having an Israeli breakfast with the eggs and the salads and fresh dark bread and the cappuccino and everything that's going on. And we finish. It's now about 9:30. He says, okay, Shai, what did I miss in the last 150 years? Take me on your horse-drawn carriage and show me something that I missed in 1867 because it didn't exist then. You've just mentioned a few of them. And by the way, Qumran is brilliant that you said that because as a writer, he would have, not just historically, but as a writer, if he had been there or come across those scrolls, that would have connected him with the authors of the scroll on an even more intimate basis. He knows somebody had to have written it. It wasn't just divinely brought down on two stone tablets. There was something even closer. But we're now finishing. He's very generous. He's paid the bill. He's left a nice tip. Where are you going to take him? Something that's modern that he would have missed. That if you could pick one thing to bring Mark Twain to today.
In Israel of
modern Israel, 2025, are you going to go to the Gaza border to see where we had a massacre almost 2 years ago? Are you going to take him to the city of David? Are you going to take him to a battlefield from the Six Day War, Kfar Etzion? Are you going to take him to a high tech place which he'll have a hard time understanding because he's 160 years older than we are?
I think that I would take him to Tel Aviv because he had been to Jerusalem and he had been to Jaffa. Okay. I would take him to Tel Aviv because in a way, Tel Aviv marks the great modern Zionist revolution that is still taking place today. When I guide people before the war, I barely guided in the past 2 years, but when I was guiding before the war broke out, and I was guiding for the second time people that I guided a few years ago, and they came to Tel Aviv, obviously, the skyline in Tel Aviv is like a... it's being changing perpetually. Okay, the amount of cranes that you see in the skyline of Tel Aviv is enormous.
Correct.
And people who come on their first visit to Tel Aviv, they are shocked by the amount of construction that you see, by the amount of building that you see. But also, I know it because my eldest son is electric engineering. He's holding his master's in electric engineering. So he's working in the high-tech industry in Tel Aviv. And I know from him and from my profession the importance of the high-tech to the, not only to the Tel Aviv economy, but to the national economy of the state of Israel, and the tremendous achievements that were discovered by this industry in Israel, and the blessing that the entire nation of Israel is getting by the tremendous development that are going on in the high tech industry. I think that's a remarkable achievement of modern Israel.
On October 7th, 2023, Israel and the Jewish people suffered a massacre and calamity of unprecedented proportion, the largest number of Jews killed in one day since the Holocaust. That this is even something that we even measure is harrowing. Since then, the Jewish people have never felt more alone, in Israel and around the world. It brings us back to when 6 million of us were murdered in the Holocaust, and few rose to protect us. However, those who did, the righteous among the nations, can never be forgotten. They serve as a beacon of light for us today and for future generations. Footsteps was born in the wake of this most recent calamity to give you the opportunity to walk in the footsteps of the righteous among the nations.
the Righteous Gentiles. Footsteps is a boutique travel experience with a personal touch. You will experience stories of the righteous among the nations, their descendants, of the Jews they saved, and the generations that came from them. Through this, you'll be inspired to follow in their footsteps to inspire new generations of righteous among the nations, especially today when so much of the world is embracing overt anti-Semitism. In a generation where standing up for Israel and the Jewish people is no longer something to be taken for granted, stories of the righteous among the nations call out to us, inspire us, and are models for today and for our next generations. Please join us and get more information at genesis123.co.
But again, the land of Israel and the state of Israel, I would say the modern state of Israel, is a rare combination of ancient history combined with modernity and high tech and all of this. So I wish you would offer me to take him to more than one place, but in case...
Well, okay, what's the second? Go ahead.
I think that the city of David is really a fascinating thing. You know, when people nowadays, most of the people, when they go to Jerusalem, they go to the old city of Jerusalem. But the real old city of Jerusalem is not the walled city, which, by the way, is very, very small. You know, it's the size of the walled city is only 1 square kilometer. That's right. That's the whole story.
And but that's the modern old city, which has been expanded from the first temple, right?
So the real old city of Jerusalem is what we call the city of David, because King David took it over from the Jebusites about 3,000 years ago. He named it after himself, called it the city of David. And the Temple Mount in his days wasn't built yet, because only his son, only Solomon, Shlomo in Hebrew, only he built the first temple on Mount Moriah, on the Temple Mount. So at the time of King David, nothing was built on Mount Moriah, and the place where people were living was the city of David. One of the main reasons for this was the fact that the one and only spring in the entire Jerusalem vicinity is located there. So water was always important. And by the way, in terms of water management and solution to water shortage, Israel is one of the leading economies and industries worldwide. And Israeli scientists are giving advice all over the world. So water was still a very, very important factor for inhabitation.
Okay.
So the city of David is obviously a fascinating place. And again, by the way, the city of David is an ongoing excavation project. The excavation never stopped there and probably will never stop in the next decades.
Correct. Well, excellent. So you're taking it from the origins of Jerusalem to the origins of the modern state, really, in terms of the city. And it's interesting to think the city of Tel Aviv today has more people who live there than lived in the whole land of Israel when he was here in 1860s.
Right.
That would have been very profound. And it would have. And if we were taking your horse-drawn carriage from Jerusalem to Tel Aviv, unlike 1867, he would have seen people everywhere. He would have seen traffic. He would have seen skylines of cities along the way, and the train, the high-speed train between the cities. It's a great vision. So with that, okay, amazing. All of that's amazing. I want to encourage people again to get the book, A Bridge to Your Roots, An Evangelical Journey Through the Land of Israel. We'll put the contact information here in the notes. And Shai, I'm so glad we got to talk about that. I want to wrap up with sort of the beginning and going back to our friend Chagai, who introduced us. You were very excited that first time that we met because you knew about our project, Root and Branch, to bring Christians to Harvest Olives. People who are following this now can still join that Root and Branch trip in October. And we're doing it, to me, It's really one of the best projects I've been involved with in the last 40 years. It's funny. You said I would like more than one thing to show Mark Twain. If I were picking the top two, three, maximum of five things that I've done in my career, Root and Branch is certainly at the top of that list. Number one, number two, number three doesn't matter. But you were very excited because you heard about this program, and not only that, and the connection that we have from different spheres, building bridges with Christians, bridges in the title of your book, bridges in the title, in the mission statement of what we do at the Genesis 1-2-3 Foundation. And of course, connecting to the land of Israel. I'm curious from your perspective as a tour guide, and I say this in a way that's a little shameless because I want people to hear from somebody who's not involved with the program, but who knows the land and experiences in the land very well. Why is that? Why is the whole idea of Root and Branch and bringing Christians to harvest olives here in 2024, 2025 so meaningful to you?
First of all, let me tell our viewers a few words about olive oil.
Okay.
And again, this is something that I deal with this in my book. Okay, before climbing Mount of Olive, I talk about it in the book. So olive in general and olive oil in particular was very, very important back then. It's still here. It's a major part of the Mediterranean diet, as people call it. But back then, olive oil was used for cooking, for lighting, for anointing, and for medical reasons and so on. And the anointing is very, very important because the word Mashiach in Hebrew means anointed. Anointed with what? Obviously with olive oil. Canola oil didn't exist back then, okay? So Kohens and kings were anointed with olive oils back then.
Kohens meaning priests.
Yeah, thank you.
The high priest.
Yeah. Just imagine, my hair is not big enough, but imagine somebody with more hair than I or David have, when somebody like this is being anointed, you can't ignore him. You know, he's like a shining beacon.
Wow.
Okay.
It wasn't just a drop of water or oil.
No. It was anointing. Okay. Wow. So from the Hebrew word Mashiach, we got the word in Hebrew Messiah. Okay. The meaning of the word Christ is also anointed. Okay? It goes back to Greek. And in Greek, the word is Christos. Christos in Greek means anointed. So here we have this triangle of three words. Okay? Mashiach, it's all started with Hebrew, with the word Mashiach, anointed with olive. And then in English, we have Messiah. And in Latin, we have Christos. In Greek we have Christos. Later on, was incorporated in Latin and in modern day English when people refer to Jesus as Jesus Christ. So the word Christ has nothing to do with cross, although it may sound similar. It has nothing to do with cross, but it's going back to the word in Greek, Christos.
So it comes from the word anoint, which it means anointed.
Anointed, exactly. So, I'm now coming back to your question.
Well, wait, before you do, I made this mistake. I went with Haggai recently to look at other places where we're going to be harvesting olives, and he also shared something like you did. And for me, as we're having this conversation, yesterday was my 21st anniversary of making Aliyah. But a lot of me still feels like a new immigrant, that it was just a few weeks earlier, and many things in Hebrew I'm learning and I don't understand. And it's taken me a long time in the past year to learn and absorb the word that's, I think, unique for harvesting olives, right?
Hasik. Mystique.
Limsok. It's a similar word. I'm not going to go there, but it's a similar word to the word for anointing. That's different. It's a different word from picking pears or carrots or cucumbers or watermelons or pistachios or anything else.
Or figs. So in Hebrew we have a different verb, to each and every harvesting act of every fruit. Yeah. So olive was and still is a major crop of the land of Israel. We know it because the Bible tells us that at the time of King David, he had a minister for the sycamores tree and the olive trees. Okay?
Oh, I didn't know that. Great.
So this is how important sycamore and olive was back then and still. So since olive and olive oil is packed with symbolism, is associated with so much importance. So the fact that people can come today to the land of Israel in order to crop the olives, to make masik, as we say in Hebrew, okay, limsok, this is to harvest the olives, and to produce olive oil, and with the funds that you get out of the olive, you go and you support the people in need around the borders. To me, as a Jewish Israeli, this is something which is very, very moving. To see the people that are doing something that is very meaningful to them and very beneficial and very meaningful to us, the people that live in Israel.
Yeah.
This is, I would say, one of those ultimate manifestations of building such a meaningful bridge between Jews and Christians in the land of Israel. And I really call upon our listeners and viewers to join this important project that Jonathan initiated.
Jonathan, with my friend Marzi, who I told you about. It was her vision. I'm just coming along for the ride. Wow, especially considering you had no idea I was going to ask you about that. That, not because it's self-serving, but what a great broad answer that teaches.
You never told me about any topic that we talk about. So I was fully surprised.
But in your book, at least you wrote it and you know what's going on if I refer to a particular chapter. But that was a great answer and also underscores that when you open this book you mentioned it, 24, Qumran and the Dead Sea, and then 25 is Bethlehem. When you go there, you're not just talking about what Bethlehem was 2,000 years ago and then what what Mark Twain saw in 1867. You're bringing it alive on so many other levels. And that's what one of the reasons I really want to encourage people to get this book, read it. But better than read it, and I'll give a pitch for you, come here and see it. And if you're not available, or I should say, if my wife, the tour guide, is not available, they should book you and bring lots of people to all these wonderful places. Shai,
meanwhile, before people come over here, or even after they've been to the land of Israel, I think that the book will help those people really to memorize, to experience once again the excitement of of the places. Obviously, nothing compares to being at the site and open the Bible and read the verses at the site. But for those of you who cannot do this journey right now, I think that my book offers you a great journey. I wrote it on the back. What if you could journey through the land of Israel without leaving your home? Huh?
Very nice. Very nice. And since we live in a virtual world today, and this is just a page turner. You want to get through. You're excited to go through. It's not just linear. You weave so many things in. I want to commend you so much on that, Shai. I'm grateful that Haggai introduced us. Before, we want to encourage people to get your book, to be in touch with you. You have a U.S. trip planned. They can book you for opportunities and here when they come and there. And the other thing, the last thing I'll just say, and then we'll wrap up. I don't know if I even told you this, but now we've spoken so much about olives and anointing, and what that means is that we, by the time the audio for this comes out, we will have produced our first bottles of Root and Branch anointing oil, which, as you noted, we're selling and using the proceeds from that to go back into projects in and around the Gaza border that have been most devastated, where people have been suffering the most in the last 2 years as a result of the war. So maybe generously, that's a different kind of anointing, making the people feel anointed, albeit not in the same biblical way. Shai Shval, what a delightful conversation.
Thank you very much.
Great book. I'm glad it took me a while to get through it. I'm glad I did, and I'm glad we are having just had this conversation. Thank you for joining today.
So again, I would like to bless all our listeners and viewers. May you be blessed from the land of Israel. Amen. And do come. Don't be afraid. And do come and visit and see everything that we talk about and much more with your own eyes.
Yes.
Because nothing can be compared to this.
And if our screen's not available, maybe Shai and I can meet you for coffee. As we've done now for the last number of years, almost since the podcast has started, Genesis 1:1-3 Foundation wants to offer you a special opportunity just for following, just for paying attention and interacting with us. We call it From Jonathan's Bookshelf. Until 2 years ago, I would offer a free copy of someone else's book to anybody who would like a comment or share the link to this program. 2 years ago, we began offering a free copy of our remarkable book, Israel the Miracle, a $75 value, a different kind of Israel experience through the eyes of Christian 75 essays by Christian leaders from all over the world. It's a remarkable book. All we ask that you do is like, comment, and share the link to this program. Shai, is it okay if I offer a free copy of your book this month as well? That we'll send to somebody? Okay, so you're going to get a potential 2-for-1, folks. Someone's going to receive one of my books and someone's going to receive one of his for free. And just all we ask that you do is like, comment, or share the link to this program. We're always grateful that the podcast is sponsored by our friends at the Willow Run Greenhouse, a different kind of tree that we've been speaking about, the willow tree in Culpeper, Virginia. If you've ever got a reason to be in the area, please pop in and thank them for helping make conversations like this possible. And also special thanks to the Coyne family as well for their meaningful sponsorship. Inspiration from Zion and all the Genesis 1-2-3 Foundation programs are made possible by donations. So please consider joining us to help continue the dialogue and build bridges. If you'd like to sponsor a future episode in honor or memory of a loved one or special occasion, please be in touch at inspirationfromzion@gmail.com. And my prayer and dedication of this episode is in honor of Shai and all of the tour guides in Israel who for the last couple of years, not just since the war began, but COVID before, have had a harder time. That by the time you're hearing this, by the time that you're seeing this, that their schedules will be full with people like you coming back to visit again.
Amen. Amen.
We would love to hear your comments as part of a dialogue and especially invite you to send questions as well, particularly about traditional Judaism for our Ask the Rabbi programs. Please share this with others who will also find it of interest. And please continue to join us right here where you will hear more meaningful conversations about unique topics relating to Israel that you won't hear anywhere else. Wherever you are in the world, I pray that you and your loved ones are all safe and healthy. And I send my blessings from right here in the Judean Mountains. God bless you.